You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2019 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, Leading Ladies. This class is titled, Dangerous Liaisons, Stories of the Other Woman.
Good morning once again. So, today's leading lady is a little different. In fact, there'll be multiple of them, each of them fulfilling a rather curious office that not every influential character in the Bible, male or female, is always a positive influence. Some lead and they have strength of character or strength of personality or strength of position and they lead, but they don't always lead in the right way, in the godly way. And some do. In fact, and I hope this isn't overly personalized, but in this case I'm going to be focusing on three characters, each of whom I ended up gaining an understanding of them that differed quite markedly in some cases from the understanding that I'd been provided as a child growing up. Our childish perceptions do mature and flourish as they should, but in some cases they even change direction somewhat. So we're going to look at Rachel, who is a favored Israelite bride, of course, the chosen bride, really, of Jacob. We're going to look at Delilah, an unusual choice, perhaps, and one whose story is seldom considered entirely from her perspective. A hired seductress, we might label her to start with. And we're going to look at the Witch of Endor, an apostate Israelite. So you can see that when I say the other woman, often that's so often meant in the very simple and narrow case of some sort of adulteress or mistress. And yet, whilst that can be seen in each of these, they actually take very different forms. See, Rachel was no adulteress or mistress. She was the second wife of Jacob, albeit not by his choosing, but by the conniving of her father. Delilah was very much another woman or someone with whom Samson would have been wiser not to have been engaged, and yet he genuinely, it seems, loved her, and she led him in a way that was quite destructive. And the Witch of Endor, of course, is the other woman, very much in a more spiritual sense, that God has said, you know, seek me for spiritual guidance. But when Saul felt that wasn't available to him, rather than accepting the Lord's decision, he would use the witch as some way to circumvent what appeared to be the decision of the father. So the other woman in quite different ways. Let's start then at the top and look at, let's start then at the bottom and look at the Witch at Endor. My slides have got, that's challenging. There we go. Excellent. I'm sure we can cope with that. And we will take a reading to start with. We're going to turn to 1 Samuel 28. Can I have a volunteer to read? Ms. Sarah, excellent. Thank you. We're not going to read it all. Verses 3, please, through 19. We're in 1 Samuel 28, verses 3 through verse 19.
Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented over him and had buried him in Ramah, his hometown. In the meantime, Saul had removed the mediums and magicians from the land. The Philistines assembled. They came and camped at Shunem. Saul mustered all Israel and camped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was terrified. So Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him, not by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by the prophets. So Saul instructed his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, so that I may go to her and inquire of her. His servants replied to him, there is a woman who is a medium in Endor. So Saul disguised himself and put on other clothing and left, accompanied by two of his men. They came to the woman at night and said, use your ritual pit to conjure up for me the one I tell you. But the woman said to him, look, you're aware of what Saul has done. He has removed the mediums and magicians from the land. Why are you trapping me so you can put me to death? But Saul swore an oath to her by the Lord. As surely as the Lord lives, you will not incur guilt in this matter. The woman replied, Who is it that I should bring up for you? He said, Bring up for me Samuel. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out loudly. The woman said to Saul, Why have you deceived me? You are Saul. The king said to her, Don't be afraid. What have you seen? The woman replied to Saul, I've seen one like a god coming up from the ground. He said to her, What about his appearance? She said, An old man is coming up. He is wrapped in a robe. Then Saul realized it was Samuel, and he bowed his face toward the ground and knelt down. Samuel said to Saul, Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? Saul replied, I'm terribly troubled. The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has turned away from me. He does not answer me, not by the prophets, nor by dreams. So I've called on you to tell me what I should do. Samuel said, Why are you asking me now that the Lord has turned away from you and has become your enemy? The Lord has done exactly as I prophesied. The Lord has torn the kingdom from your hand and has given it to your neighbor David. Since you did not obey the Lord and did not carry out his fierce anger against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this thing to you today. The Lord will hand you and Israel over to the Philistines. Tomorrow, both you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also hand the army of Israel over to the Philistines.
Thank you. Excellent. So, a passage that surely raises some questions. It was introduced to me as a sort of a stereotypical problem passage, given all the sort of supernatural stuff that seemed to be going along. And yet, the more I appreciate this passage, I realize it's actually not really that at all. One of the questions we might ask is, certain questions are thrown up. How did the witch know? She came to a sudden realization that the disguised man who was her visitor was indeed King Saul. You'll see that she comes to that realization in verse 12. We might ask the question, did God actually genuinely resurrect Samuel? What really happened in that moment? And if he did, does this signal God giving an approval to the witch, or indeed to the general practice of witchcraft, in that the witch made arrangements to raise Samuel and God was complicit, seemingly, in that arrangement? Does this story suggest people are conscious after death? There's clearly a conversation going on between Saul, who is living, and Samuel, who has previously died. And what does this story actually teach us about the afterlife? Those are just some of the questions that come up, and we'll see we can roll quite smoothly through these as we appreciate this scenario from the perspective of our leading lady. How does the witch know her visitor is King Saul? Well, let's consider what she does know. What she does know, as you and I know, is that King Saul is a head taller, or head and shoulders, I should say, head and shoulders taller than other men, not necessarily than every other man on the planet. Let's just think of a modern corollary. What is going to be, what's the height of a tall man in North America? What would you say a tall man was? Giants have spoken. I'll go with this. I think 6'2 would be seen as a tall man. So if you're going to be head and shoulders above 6'2, you're going to want to be about a foot taller than that, would you think? Something like that, 10 inches or so. So you're going to be 7'1", about 7'2". So Saul was, by our perspective, about 7'2". King Saul is about 7'2", let's say, in our currency. And surely the witch can't help but notice that her visitor is also 7'2". Now, we're told Saul was disguised, right? But, you know, there's only so much you can do. You know, an orange mustache and a flower in your hair is only going to do so much when you stand at 7'2". Saul is very close by at Gilboa. She knows this. The armies of the armies of Israel are encamped at Gilboa, about 5 miles away, whereas Saul might normally, in his sort of palatial realm, be about 2 or 3 days' travel away, about 80 miles away to the south. So she knows King Saul, the one who has pronounced her death, is right close by and is about 7'2", as is her visitor. And she knows that King Saul has expelled mediums from the land, so if he were to come to her, he would be bound to be disguised, because he isn't just going to march in and say, are there any witches here? You know, it seems an unlikely announcement. What else do we know about her? She's still in business, in an illegal practice, right? Fatally illegal practice. So she's a smart woman. She's smart enough to be alive and practicing in an environment which is quite literally lethal to her. And I'm not trying to take sides and say, go witchcraft, but, you know, she's at least a smart woman who's staying alive in an extremely, ultimately hostile environment. So these are all the things that she knows. She knows her unknown and very tall visitor has two servants. It's announced that he has two servants, so clearly he's interacting with them in a manner to suggest he's one in high authority. The very tall visitor requests to see God's prophet Samuel. We might not realize how unusual that is. When we read the Bible, we know Samuel is one of the good guys. And so maybe we sort of connect with him as one of our buddies. But actually, this was not how Samuel would have been perceived at the time. We're told this. Samuel brought what emotion with him? Yeah, fear, terror. Samuel terrified everyone. So he's an extremely unlikely person to be requested. Here's a generic quote. When Samuel arrived in a particular town, the elders of that town trembled and said, do you come in peace? And please don't destroy us all. So a very unusual request. And she also knows that Samuel generally accompanies 7'2" King Saul. And here are some references to establish that. So once you put all those together, and note one extra thing, that when she performs whatever ritual she's doing, Samuel appears. You put all that together, and I suggest to you, how can she not know it's King Saul? I mean, just a room temperature IQ would be all that would be required, plus that information to deduce, I think I know who you are. So I don't think we have anything mystical or supernatural going on when the woman at that point realizes, oh, this is Saul. I'm in serious trouble. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out or screamed somehow at the top of her voice. What does this reveal? What did she normally scream as part of her practice? No, why not? Say, Julia? Right, so, you know, huge outlandish screams would eventually attract the neighbors as to what's going on, right? If you're involved in an illegal practice, her witchcraft was in secret, so she would never normally scream. Here's a real-life true corollary. Our brothers and sisters in Vietnam practice, if you like, meet together, assemble and celebrate their services before the Lord in secret. They don't sing hymns. Right? And at one point, there was a possibility we'd be recognized as official, and some officials from the government came along and attended their service and said, well, one thing seems wrong about your service is you don't sing hymns. And I'm like, we're in secret. Oh, yeah, right. So I don't think she normally screams. That's going to give things away. That suggests she was genuinely terrified. If she was genuinely terrified, what does that suggest? It suggests that something unexpected and shocking had happened. What was the unexpected thing that had happened?
Something supernatural.
Right, exactly so. That Samuel had appeared, directly implying normally nobody appeared, right? And she merely said she saw whatever she wanted to see or whatever she perceived someone else to be. The Bible therefore says it's Samuel, most likely because it was. So we can see God has intervened here and terrified the woman because God is doing what he's doing. But this is not her power that has brought Samuel to bear. Otherwise, she wouldn't scream in terror. What does this imply? God can raise the dead, but the witch never could. How's that for a definitely non-problem passage? This is not a problem passage of Scripture. This is directly supporting everything that the rest of Scripture supports. God can raise the dead. Humans can't. Even the humans who pretend they can sometimes can't. At any time. Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? three interesting facts in that tiny sentence. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" To whom did he not say that? Because he knows she's got nothing to do with it. She's a bystander. Samuel said it to Saul because he knows God raised him up because of Saul, not that the witch had any significant part to play. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And disturbed is consistent with Samuel being in a condition which is not conscious. So we're not talking about a resident afterlife prior to a resurrection. Disturbed means he has been changed from the quiescent state in which he had resided. And finally, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" What's significant about the word up? Out of the ground. So who said down? What? It's not down, right? He's the good guy. He's supposed to be in heaven, right? It's consistent with coming up from the pit, from Sheol. It is inconsistent with coming from heaven. As you rightly say, Stephen, it should otherwise be down. So again, this is absolutely not a problem passage. Everything is playing out exactly consistent with our normal doctrines. And Samuel says, "The Lord will hand over both Israel and you, Saul, to the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." That shows us something extra as well, doesn't it? Because Saul and Saul's sons were rejected by God. But Samuel, of course, was accepted. So that tells us that the faithful, i.e. Samuel, and the rejected, Saul and his sons, go to the same place after death. It is not that Samuel has gone up and Saul's sons have gone down. But rather, says Samuel, we're all going to be together this time tomorrow. So we actually learn, we can step through this very easily. How did the witch know that the disguised man was King Saul? A host of clues reveals this. No supernatural deduction is required. Did God genuinely resurrect Samuel? I suggest yes. Her scream and the record of Samuel's presence in simple language suggest this. Although, as a caveat, Saul couldn't see him, evidently. At least not initially. If God did, does this give approval to the witch or to witchcraft? No. The account shows the witch wasn't involved at all and never expected any of this to happen. Her witchcraft had always been a fraud, or if she believed in it herself, unlikely, a delusion. Does this story suggest people are conscious after death? By no means. Samuel's own testimony implied that he was not conscious. What does this story teach about the afterlife? It teaches that both good and evil go to the same place, and that place is below. So never teach your Sunday school class, I suggest you, don't ever suggest that this is any form of problem passage, this occasion of the witch at Endor. It's absolutely straightforward. It's a fascinating story and rightly included, but it doesn't actually pose any difficult problems whatsoever when it's read in a straightforward manner. Here's the interesting thing, though, from the point of view of that I'd like to suggest that gave me a different perspective on the witch herself. What happened to the witch? Well, let's consider her spiritual peers. Who are her spiritual peers? Her spiritual peers, in my opinion, are those who are engaged in apostate worship or in some form of apostasy and yet come face to face with the living God. And it usually results in terror. And that seems reasonable, even for the faithful. So, for example, I think of the Gentile sailors with Jonah. They were worshipping foreign gods. They were praying to their gods and saying, "Oi, you, Hebrew, why aren't you praying to your God? We're praying to ours." In fact, they were outshining him in that respect. And as a consequence, at the end of all the account, then those sailors feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to him and took vows. Direct and very genuine and sincere and immediate conversion to the God of Israel. I think of Rahab in the same way, Rahab of Jericho, who was engaged in prostitution. "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen upon us." So Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. She dwells in Israel to this day, and does she not indeed, concerning the genealogy in which she is included. So in that context, the woman of Endor, engaged in witchcraft, when she saw Samuel, when she witnessed resurrection, she cried out at the top of her voice. And if she is to be taken in the same vein as Rahab, or the same vein as the Gentile sailors alongside Jonah sailing from Joppa, there's every possibility, and I would suggest to you, the witch may very well have been one of the most sincere and genuine converts, as indeed are these. And we may, I speak presumptuously, have the great pleasure to see her in the kingdom of heaven. And that's not the impression I was given as I came out of my Sunday school classes, but to me it's the most reasonable conclusion that I have given the scriptural text to hand. And I find that fascinating. Time is pressing. Let's slide on straight into our next dangerous liaison, which is Delilah's story. Now, this is a strange one. In order to approach Delilah's story, I think we need to know about two symbols. Neither of these are going to be challenging to the mind. Both of these are completely consistent with common interpretation. The symbol of a lion. What does a lion represent? I think you'll agree in Scripture, a lion represents a powerful killer. Doesn't have to be evil. It could be a good killer. The lion is the tribe of Judah because Judah was a very powerful force, very powerful army. And in fact, God describes himself as a lion here in Hosea. This is about 70 references where you see this association. Hosea 5, if you've got time to turn it up one day, God will say, I am going to be a lion even to my own people. I will spare no one. I will rend them and I will capture them. Or it could be an evil one. 1 Peter 5, we're more familiar with, the devil stalks around like a lion seeking whom he may devour. Either good or evil, it's a powerful killer. Does that make logical sense? Yes, because it is a real danger, and it was a real contemporary danger. There were lions, maybe not the African lion as shown, but there were lions, certainly of pumas and cougars and mountain lions, as we might call them, very commonly in the land of Israel. And we also need to know about the symbol of the vineyard. What would be our take for the symbol of a vineyard? Israel, potentially. I would suggest to you more broadly, and that this is entirely common with what you've said, Howard, from God's point of view, the symbol of a fertile woman. And that's how God speaks about Israel. You will be my bride. You will bear me fruit. This comes up about 20 times. Isaiah 5 is actually a good one that Howard is alluding to there, where God speaks about Israel as his fertile woman, as his wife. Why? Well, a vineyard is where wine grows, to state the obvious. Wine, we know, is a symbol of blood, because Jesus himself said so, amongst other implications. And blood is a symbol of? The blood is the life, as is hammered into our head many times in the early books. So if the vineyard is where wine grows, and wine is blood, and blood is life, then the vineyard must be where life grows, which, of course, makes perfect sense, because life grows inside a fertile woman. So, two symbols, which I think are fairly easy. Lion, a powerful killer. Vineyard, a fertile woman. Why do we care? Because Samson meets a lion in a vineyard. Think about that. Samson meets a powerful killer inside a fertile woman. For Samson, women, to whom he is evidently, literally, fatally attracted, form a killer for him. Let's look at the verse itself. Samson is with his mother and father, and he's taking them down to visit a Philistine woman with whom he's greatly taken. This isn't even Delilah. And his father, Manoah, and his mother are greatly disappointed by this. Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and mother, and as they approached the vineyards of Timnah, notice how we needed to know it was the vineyards. We didn't really care. It didn't really matter. As they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring towards him. Now, there's a photograph of a vineyard. It's actually in South Africa, not in Israel, but close enough. And you get the sense vineyards are actually not where lions appear. Suddenly there was a lion appeared that they hadn't noticed. And we can speak even with some confidence from a Californian perspective. We have vineyards. We have mountain lions. Mountain lions don't live in vineyards, period. They don't at all. If you look at the picture, you can see why. Vineyards offer very little cover visually. You stick out a mile in a vineyard. You might think it's all covered and leafy. It's not. Generally, it's a lot of open space. Lions like tall, dry grass where they can hide or to be on nice, dry rocks because they're a bit prissy about getting their paws wet and such like. Seriously, they are. So you won't see them in a vineyard ever. So why do we need to know that the lion came roaring out of the vineyard? The lion came out of the foreign vineyard. There was danger for Samson in fertile women, whether he ever chose to accept it or not. And so I think that's why that's sown to us. And this is how the Bible works in such subtle patterns. If we read too fast, we miss them. Now, this particular lion and this particular Philistine woman wasn't a major threat to him. This lion he tore apart with his hands. And this particular woman he lost, and he didn't seem to care at all. So maybe he even became blasé. Oh, women are no threat to me. They come, they go. I suffer nothing, no problem. Well, that won't prove to be the case. Did you also notice the fun grammatical mismatch there? Good, isn't it? As they approach the vineyards of Timnah together, the lion comes roaring at him. The lion, well, where were the other two? Are a respectful 3 miles away? No, they were together. The lion came roaring at them. No, says God, you need to know it came roaring at him. The lion is his problem. His father Manoah doesn't have a lion in his vineyards. He doesn't have a problem with the women that he keeps encountering. And his mother, possibly even less so. But Samson, it's the problem. It's Samson's problem. It's Samson's danger, these lions in the vineyard. Very carefully written scriptures, so beautiful. So then eventually, of course, he encounters a vineyard in the valley of Sorek, one might say, in which there is a lion that's so powerful it will essentially literally claw out his eyes and cost him his life. And when Delilah presses him about the source of his strength, Samson deceives her 3 times over. Now, I don't know if you ever noticed this, but let's look at Samson's 3 lies. When he first lied to her about the source of his strength, what did he say? Who can remember off the top of their head? Absolutely no one. Fabulous. Pretty good, yes. Tie me up with 7 bowstrings. Okay, and that didn't work. What was his next? That was the third one. Yeah, you won ahead. You're absolutely right. So what was the second one? New ropes. Tie me up with new ropes. Whether he's actually misleading her much or just suggesting he has a predilection to be tied up, I'm not sure. But anyway, and his final one, as Andy has said, take the 7 braids of my hair and do something with them. Either weave them into the rafters of the house, or other translations have different suggestions. Samson wore his hair in 7 braids. Some of the versions make this clear, which of course matches with the 7 here. I don't know if you see what I'm trying to say here. Either he wasn't very good at lying, or he kind of really wanted to tell her all along. I mean, look at those 3 answers. When the answer is don't cut my hair off, you couldn't give 3 better clues. He's got 7 braids of hair, and he says, well, look at, try something with 7 bowstrings. And a bowstring isn't entirely different from hair. In fact, the thing on all of planet Earth that looks most like braided hair is a rope. And the next thing he says is, oh yeah, let's do something with braided ropes, shall we? And finally, he's like, well, why don't you take the 7 braids of my hair and do whatsoever? I mean, these are terrible lies in a way. All of Samson's attempted lies point quite directly at the truth. And I don't have an explanation for why Samson is almost giving it away each time. I'm sorry? He does like riddles, but what I'm saying is this is a rubbish riddle. The one with the lion and honey was really good, right? He fooled those Philistines completely. They couldn't figure out a thing, right? They had to cheat to get the answer. I wouldn't have to cheat to get the real answer out of this, really. Think of what you could have said. You could have said, you know what? If you bring me outside when I'm asleep by moonlight and you recite this particular incantation, right, my strength will disappear. That's a good one. How about this? If you mix this particular potion and let me drink so much as a drop of it, my strength will disappear. That would be a good one. He might even say, hey, the source of my strength is nothing about me, on me locally. But there is an amulet hidden at my father's house, which if you melt that down, my strength will... See, I'm a really good liar. Samson's rubbish. But you're right, Sarah, is like he has been good in time past, but these are not good. There's something in him that's making him almost tell the truth every time. And of course, as you'll have noticed, even as a child I noticed, Delilah repeatedly reveals her treachery. Right? The first time she has him tied up with 7 bowstrings, you say, oh, hang on a minute. This is not the girl for me. But no, he gets suckered 3 times over, and it's still he tells her. There's some very powerful dynamic here, and I have a suspicion it's that D desperately awful thing called love, there's some powerful force at work here, and that is supernatural, of course, that is meaning that he stays with her and keeps actually, in the end, of course, tells her the truth. Samson's resistance to Delilah is actually only as strong as his weakest day. And that's where we need to take the lesson for ourselves. I don't know what troubles you. You don't know what troubles me. Let's call it her Delilah. Because it's always good to blame something female, you're right. And the point is, there's some new material here and some very old stuff, you know, nothing new under the sun. Samson's resistance, your resistance to Delilah is only as strong as your weakest day. What does that mean? If our resistance to temptation is only as strong as our weakest day, just don't live with her. Samson constantly went down to visit with her, to stay with her for days and days at a time. Reducing that exposure would have reduced his risk. It's stating the obvious, and yet it's an obvious that perhaps we all need to hear again and again. Don't dwell with Delilah, not when you're trying to tell her the truth every time, and you know that truth will be absolutely debilitating to your spiritual, and in this case, physical life. But he gives in. And Delilah, therefore, stands in line to receive the blood money for that betrayal. The lords of the Philistines had come up to Delilah previously and said to her, "Seduce Samson, see where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, and we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." An unusual number, that. 1,100 pieces of silver. I suppose I should have done the research to find out what that's worth in... I don't really care what that's worth in modern terms. It sounds to me like a fantastic amount of money. And it's not just 1,100 she's going to get. It's 1,100 multiplied by the number of conspirators, which we're not told, unless it's the lords of the Philistines, in which case it's explicitly 5, and she's going to get 5,500 pieces of silver. That sounds like an awful lot of money. That's all I need to know about that. Question is, was she ever paid? Silly question, you might think. Well, let's have a look. Remember Vashti? We've gone off track now. She's going to come chronologically downstream. Vashti, the woman who had the temerity to say no. The king was merry with wine, and he commanded to bring Queen Vashti in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty. But Queen Vashti decided that being paraded before a bunch of drunken males was not her Tuesday afternoon plan, and therefore refused to come. And the king became enraged. And the king said, "Well, what should I do about this?" And he asked his council. This is relevant, believe it or not. What did the counselors tell him? Indeed, get rid of her, get a new wife. But why? What's the risk? You risk setting a dangerous precedent, they said. The queen's behavior will be made known to all women. If it can be known, I'll just paraphrase, you can read the real words there. If it can be known that even the king's bride would refuse him something, there will be brides up and down the land, wives up and down the land, refusing their husbands. This sets a disastrous precedent. We can't let this stand without some obvious, visible punishment that ensures we will all get to keep our wives in line. That's the essence of exactly what they said. So that was Vashti's case. Think then what the lords of the Philistines, who are powerful politicians, have promised to Delilah. Samson is a powerful political force, basically a walking army. Tell you what, betray him. Throw your man under the bus, and we'll make you, and you'll live fabulously wealthy life for the rest of time. That's the worst thing a politician could do, right? They've all got wives, probably more than one. They're going to set the precedent that if you betray your husband and fling him under the bus, your husband will be killed, and you will conveniently live a life of fabulous wealth hereafter. That's not a good idea. Any wicked man knows that. And as a result, in Vashti's case, she can't remain queen by that wicked reasoning. And therefore, by corollary, in Delilah's case, what? You can't let her live. That's just logic. There's no scriptural verses behind that yet. But that's just logic. You can't let her live. You have to kill her. We will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver, a number that appears in the Bible three times only, or really twice, is one verse is mentioned twice. And the only other place it's mentioned is in Judges 17. I hate chapter breaks. You take that chapter break out and you would read it as part of the story of Samson and Delilah. Because it's a rather male-focused thing, the moment Samson is dead, they say, oh, chapter break, end of story. It's not the end of the story. The very next verses, there is a man randomly confessing to his mother, and I'm going to paraphrase, there's the real words. He says, you know that those 1,100 pieces of silver that went missing from your purse, and you got so mad that you swore an oath, said, well, Mom, don't worry about it. I took them. And not only that, turns out I don't actually need them, so I can give them back to you. And he does. He needed 1,100 pieces of silver for something. He needed to pay a debt, apparently. Then the debt went away. And that is the Bible. Implications. The silver pieces were probably being extorted from him or pressured from him by the lords of the Philistines. He's an Ephraimite himself. They were for Delilah. But that debt no longer needs paying. Why does that debt no longer need paying? Because the creditor is no longer with us. And I think that's without stating the case in absolute fact, otherwise we'd have known it since Sunday school days, that is the clear and only reasonable implication of the ending of the story. And so that gave me an entirely new read on Delilah, that I think she was a manipulated victim as much as ever what Samson was. Samson had been foolish, but Delilah had no choices. The lords of the Philistines had found her and said, either we see Samson has taken an interest in you, or you're the type of woman with the looks or figure or whatever it is that Samson seems to go for, work for us. And it's not like she had a choice. Like, work for us if you'd like to. No, you're going to do this. And the way they keep her interested is say, we're going to make you fabulously wealthy. But in the end, the debt never needed paying. And so I get to see Delilah in a rather different light, in a rather more sympathetic light in that sense. And finally, let's consider Rachel's story. And I had to make this one a lot shorter than I wanted to, just to fit the allotted time. But we have time to see it just a little bit. Rachel, of course, is the beloved of Jacob. He had seen her. He'd set his eyes upon her. He'd set his heart upon her to have her as his wife. And Jacob married two sisters, not from his own choice, in fairness to Jacob. It was the manipulations of the two sisters' father, Laban, Jacob's own uncle, who orchestrated this. And he first marries Leah and later Rachel. And Laban, being Laban, ensures that he extracts plenty of years of labor for this. And it starts off, how many years did Jacob work for Leah? Seven. I have seven. Any advance on seven? I want to advance on seven. Tammy? Zero. Right? He works 7 years for Rachel and gets Leah. And says, no, I want Rachel. And so Laban says, oh, I misheard you, sorry. That'd be another 7 years, please. And so he works another 7 years for Rachel and gets Rachel, albeit at the start of that 7 years. It's important that we remember that because otherwise we answer too reflexively. He works 7 years for Leah. No, he didn't. He didn't work a day for her. Now let's think of that from her perspective. She's now one of two wives. There's my young, cute sister for whom my husband worked 14 years. But he didn't work 14 years. He worked a total of 20. What were the other six? He worked 6 years for cattle. He worked 20 years for Laban. And Leah, at any time in her life, can now go out and stand in the field and think, yeah, even the cattle were worth 6 years' labor to my husband. My beautiful sister was worth 14. Me? Not a day. Leah, in human terms, is a father's unwanted burden and a husband's unwanted freebie. And if you think that's crass language, it's because it is. And it's crass language because it's a terribly crass situation. And not of Leah's construction, and in fairness, not of Rachel's either. It's a terribly crass construction of Laban's making and of Jacob's complicity. And I think it's worthwhile that we remember that, because Leah's situation is truly a desperate one. Do not take your wife's sister as a rival wife, says God. Now, in fairness, the book of Leviticus is written downstream chronologically from the time of Jacob. But given that that's a principle of God and we know his character is consistent, we begin to get the implication. Jacob, I know who you wanted, said God. I know, but this isn't the one for you. Leah is the one for you. No thanks, says Jacob. I'll be doing it my way, not yours. And even if I have to work 14 years, I'll get what I want. And he gets what he wants. But at what expense? The expense that one of his wives is unloved, for at least a portion, if not a large portion, of their marriage. And the wives and sisters, who may have had a perfectly reasonable relationship beforehand, are now competing with each other. They are forced to competition by the situation into which they've both been engineered. Rachel has her own story. It's very short. I can put the whole thing on the screen. She shows up in a number of verses, of course, but there is one story which is exclusively hers. And it's when her father, Laban, is searching for the household idols which she has stolen. Here's the story in its completeness. Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent, but he did not find the stolen idols, so he entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, see how much he trusts his children, felt all about the tent but didn't find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." So he searched, but he didn't find the household gods. So we don't stand in judgment upon any human, but we can consider actions at least. Let's consider Rachel's actions and the moral compass which they imply. One of the simplest ways, or even a simplistic way, to consider her actions is just to look at the Ten Commandments. That's only a three-verse story. The first commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength, and thou shalt have no other gods before me. How did Rachel do on commandment one? Yes, okay. You can do the gladiatorial thing if you like, I don't mind. That's no. How about no wood or stone idols? Not yes. You can duck. I don't think they were plastic. That was the 1920s. That's a fail. No blasphemy. If you want to understand blasphemy, I suggest in any context, substitute it with the modern word cheapening. Don't cheapen the name of your God. Was the name of the Lord God cheapened by her worship of the idols? That's another fail. The fourth commandment, you must work and you must rest, essentially. You must work 6 days and must rest one. How did she do there? She might have done right. Absolutely. We won't have convictions we don't need. Honor your father and your mother. How about that one? Not so good. Okay, so in a golf analogy, on the outbound five, she's doing quite poorly. She's bogeyed at least four of those. No murder. No complaints. No adultery. No complaints. Don't steal. Whoops. Yeah. Don't lie. And don't covet. Yeah. So it's a three-verse story. In three verses, you've managed to machine gun down seven of the Ten Commandments. That's not just ungodliness. That's called high-efficiency ungodliness. Rachel is not, and I don't say that, I'm not mocking or condemning. But if we are to read that story as her story, I know of no other that's really her story. She is not presented. She's presented as beautiful, physically beautiful, but godliness, clearly there's quite a bit lacking. That she's an idolater and a thief and a liar, etc. So she's not presented as a godly woman. And her burial place, not of great importance. She died, obviously, in childbirth of Benjamin, the last of Jacob's 12. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Which means one of two things, either that she was buried at Bethlehem on the way to Ephrath, or that Ephrath is a synonym for Bethlehem and she was buried somewhere else on the way. The exact location isn't important, except to show where she isn't buried. She isn't buried where all the faithful fathers are buried. And let's just consider that as our essentially penultimate or ultimate slide. It is Lear, however, who is buried in the cave of Machpelah alongside the fathers of the faithful. In fact, if we consider, there are six people, as I'm sure you know, six who are buried in the cave of Machpelah. The cave holds Abraham and his wife Sarah, but not Hagar, Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and Jacob and his wife Leah, and not Rachel, and not Bilhah, and not Zilpah, or any of the other handmaids or concubines. And that, in fairness, is at Jacob's direction, that he gives direction that Leah should be buried there. So it seems there is some affirmation that she was the rightful wife. Whether that came even before she died, one can only hope that she did not live as dreadful a life as could have been. And in fact, this is just a little flourish, and some of you may think this going a little step too far, but I'll give it to you, and you may enjoy it or reject it as you choose. But there is the word, this is the spelling, this is the Hebrew spelling of Israel itself. You'll read from right to left, of course, starting with the Y or the J, Yisrael. And to put it in its Roman letters, or we can leave it in the Hebrew ones, it'll work just as well, Yod and the diacritical I, the letter Shin here, and Resh, and Aleph, and Lamed, for Yisrael, the spelling of Israel. And maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, but those are the six initials of the people who are buried there. Jacob, Isaac, Sarah, R, Rebecca, not Rachel, A, Abraham, and L, Leah. Last, but by no means least, Leah. So maybe that's just a happy, fun coincidence. Maybe there's something in there that God's showing us a pretty pattern. You decide for yourself. I'm happy either way. Either way, Israel is buried in its entirety in the cave of Machpelah. And I don't mean this as a pronouncement on her soul, but Rachel does not finish in that community. Rachel is buried elsewhere on the way to Ephrath, wherever that may be, outside of the community of Yisrael. Whether that's something we're supposed to learn about her eternity, that's for God to decide, and I don't wish to interfere. But that, again, is a very different take on Rachel than I was given from Sunday school years. So in each of these three cases, really, in case of Rachel, the favorite Israelite bride, or Delilah, a Philistine seductress, or the witch of Endor, an apostate Israelite, I end up, when I focus on these female characters who have so much to teach us, I end up coming to the conclusion that Rachel, well, she was an idolater, and she was finally buried and left outside of the cave of Yisrael, if you will. And that's a fact. I'm not going to read anything into that fact, but that's a fact. Delilah, the Philistine seductress, if we read carefully and ignore that ridiculous chapter break, we'll find that the story finishes with a clear implication of her assassination. And when I was taught the story of Samson and Delilah, it's a great Sunday school story for all sorts of different reasons. It always ends with the death of Samson. And the sort of seemingly irrelevant character of Delilah is just trailing off in the nothingness. No, in actual fact, the Bible takes care to wrap up that end and presents her in quite a sympathetic manner, if you read carefully, that she was a manipulated victim as much as Samson was, more so in the sense that Samson was complicit in his own destruction through stupidity, but she was not. And the witch of Endor, an apostate Israelite for sure, and witchcraft a condemned practice, I have little doubt in my mind that, like the Gentile sailors with Jonah and like Rahab of Jericho, she was, through her great shock at seeing the power of the real, the living God, she was converted entirely from her apostasy. And those are the thoughts that I have looking at these voices of women whose stories are seldom, if ever, told, even when women of the Bible are focused upon. These are three unlikely characters, their stories to hear. And I think it's very worthwhile listening to them and learning from them as we can. Thank you very much.